Welcome to The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the January 9th edition of the magazine. On this week's cover is a black and white globe turned to show both American continents, contrasted against a sunset-tinted background. Hovering above the globe are three military helicopters, each with drop lines circling the Earth vertically, as if holding the continents in their position. Headline reads, "The Donroe Delusion." That's for our cover lead story. The Donroe Delusion. Is Donald Trump's world the strong take what they can? The other four leader articles this week are Blaming Outsiders. Does Japan have a foreigner problem? The Utter Merde Show. France is paralyzed and everyone is to blame. The Factory Funk. Do not mistake a resilient global economy for populist success. And Pipeline Dreams. AI is transforming the pharma industry for the better. And now, let's start with our cover leader. The Donroe Delusion. In Donald Trump's world, the strong take what they can. That will be bad for America and everyone else. For 12 years, Nicolas Maduro terrorized Venezuela. He stole elections and, when people objected, his goons killed, raped, or tortured them by suffocating them with plastic bags. His comrades looted and mismanaged the economy so wantonly that GDP fell by 69%. A quarter of the population fled abroad. Both the economic collapse and the exodus have been worse than is typical during the bloodiest of civil wars. Mr. Maduro was also an international menace, colluding with drug gangs, threatening oil-rich Guyana, and propping up Cuba's communist tyranny with cheap fuel. He supported Hezbollah, helped Iran evade sanctions, and gave Russia and China a foothold across the water from Florida. And then he was gone, snatched by U.S. Special Forces on January 3rd. This raid matters far beyond Venezuela. One reason is how it happened. It was a stunning display of hard power and its limits. Another is why it happened. Rather than citing democracy or human rights as American presidents once did, Donald Trump said he aimed to grab Venezuela's oil and assert dominance over the Western Hemisphere. And third is when it happened. Mr. Trump is hastening the demise of the old order of UN resolutions, international law, and universal values. The unfolding drama will help determine what takes place next. First, consider the how. No other military force could have swooped in and seized the despot and his wife so surgically. It took less than 3 hours. Not a single American died, though a reported 32 Cuban spooks guarding the Maduros did. By January 5th, the odious couple were in court in New York, facing drug charges and possible life sentences. America's adversaries have been warned. Yet the story also illustrates the limits to military power. This was a raid, not an invasion. Scarred by failures in Afghanistan and Iraq, America is attempting from afar something much less than regime change. Mr. Maduro is gone, but his machinery of plunder and repression remains. His vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, seems to have taken charge. The regime's motorbike militias, the colectivos, are on the streets reasserting terror. With many gun-toting groups in Venezuela, an army with 2,400 generals and much paranoia at the top, a descent into conflict is also possible. Mr. Trump says he now runs Venezuela, by which he means that Ms. Rodriguez has to do what he says or else. Yet he will struggle to enforce his will. True, the U.S. Navy still blocks the oil exports on which Venezuela depends. On January 7th, American forces seized two tankers used to ship Venezuelan oil, one near Iceland and one in the Caribbean. But Mr. Trump's threats to station troops in Venezuela or to launch repeated raids, each months in the planning, are not credible. The second lesson from Venezuela is the why. The snatching of Mr. Maduro is a worked example of the Donroe Doctrine, Mr. Trump's vision of how America should assert itself in its region. American dominance in the Western Hemisphere will never be questioned again, he crowed. Won't happen. Doctrine is about power and natural resources, not values. Venezuela's most popular politician is a Democrat, the Nobel Prize-winning Maria Corina Machado. Mr. Trump dismissed her as lacking support. Yet she's so popular that Mr. Maduro barred her from the presidential election he stole in 2024. Mr. Trump means that she does not control the army. He prefers to back the people with the guns instead. They have no interest in fair elections, which would mean losing power and risking jail. Venezuelans still hope Mr. Trump can broker a transition to democracy, but he shows little inclination to try. His national security strategy, published in late 2025, spoke of enlisting friends and expanding alliances in the Americas. It's now clear that this invitation comes at the barrel of a gun. Within hours of announcing Mr. Maduro's capture, Mr. Trump was also threatened Colombia, Cuba, Greenland, and Mexico. He makes clear he craves natural resources, mostly for America. Mr. Trump has laid claim to Venezuela's underexploited oil reserves, the world's largest, and says that the United States will receive 30 million to 50 million barrels straight away. Venezuela's oil industry has been so badly managed that, with American help, raising output by a little should be possible. Yet Mr. Trump's boast that he can rapidly and profitably restore production to previous levels is deluded. Demand is weak and the country is short of skills and capital. The oil companies are wary of taking costly, decades-long, multi-billion dollar bets that Venezuela will be safe. Third is what this means for the Americas and the world. Smaller countries close to the United States may feel they have no choice but to submit to Mr. Trump's bullying. Yet in the years to come, many leaders will seek to reclaim their sovereignty, and many countries will quietly seek closer ties with other powers, including China. Unless coercion is balanced by attraction, Mr. Trump's hemispheric doctrine will eventually fail, and in doing so, weaken the United States. In stating so brazenly that might makes right, Mr. Trump has already undermined America's alliances. Greenland is a self-governing part of Denmark, which is a member of NATO. Seizing it would destroy the alliance. America's Pacific allies will also conclude that to depend on Mr. Trump is to be vulnerable to his predations. By contrast, China and Russia are experts in navigating a world where the strong impose their will on the weak. Mr. Trump may believe that each will stick to its own sphere of influence. But where do those spheres begin and end? As countries everywhere feel emboldened to encroach on their neighbors, the dismal prospect is of an aggressive, border-shifting 19th-century world, but armed with 21st-century weapons. America was a successful superpower because its self-interest and realpolitik were turbocharged by an avowed faith in universal values of democracy and human rights. Mr. Trump believes that, far from being a unique strength in foreign powers, that was a foolish indulgence. His raid on Venezuela is likely to show how wrong he is. That was the Donroe Delusion. In Trump's world, the strong take what they can. Next leader article. Blaming outsiders. Does Japan have a foreigner problem? Yes, but it's not what populist politicians say it is. Japan is consumed by talk of a foreigner problem. The story goes that the country has been overrun by ill-mannered immigrant workers, misbehaving tourists, and opportunistic foreign investors. But Japan's real problem is not that it hosts too many foreigners, it's that it has too few. Foreigners moved to the center of political debate after the upstart do-it-yourself or Senseito party rose to a Japanese-first platform to big gains in last year's upper house election. In October, the panicked ruling Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP, chose as its new leader Takaichi Sanai, who launched her campaign for the job by lambasting foreign tourists who she said, without evidence, had been kicking sacred deer in Nara, an ancient capital. In Japan's polite political culture, this was nearly as provocative as Donald Trump's false claim that Haitian immigrants were eating American pets. Since becoming prime minister, Ms. Takaichi has proposed tightening the screws on foreigners in the hopes of winning back voters to the LDP. Her administration has talked of crackdowns on people who overstay visas, taxes on tourists, restrictions on property purchases, and caps on foreign labor. A package of measures may be put forth later this month. Vilifying outsiders may make for good politics, but in the long run, it's misguided. The true cause of voters' frustrations are economic struggles. Cracking down on foreigners will not heal the underlying malaise. If anything, it may make it worse. The backdrop is demographic change. Japan's population is expected to decrease by 30% to 87 million in 2070. Ms. Takaichi's mentor, the late Abe Shinzo, recognized that Japan needed to open up if it was to keep thriving. When he served as prime minister, he let in more migrant workers and encouraged tourism. The number of foreign residents in Japan has doubled since 2010 to 3.7 million. The number of foreign visitors has quadrupled over the same period, reaching some 40 million last year. Many foreigners live in Japan on temporary work visas. These programs are much better than no immigration at all, but in Japan, where migrants are often treated as expendable cogs, not people who might settle and have families, such schemes hold back integration, which in turn causes tension. And as the foreign population in Japan has risen, mainstream politicians often have been reluctant to talk about it. That has helped populists paint the arrivals as a silent invasion. Some popular worries reflect real problems that can be fixed. Stricter oversight of foreign investors who buy land next to sensitive sites, such as military bases, is wise. Imposing Japanese language requirements for permanent residents is reasonable, too. Over-tourism has turned Kyoto's best-known temples into mosh pits during cherry blossom season. But broader fears about social breakdown and loss of traditions are overstated. Japan is an island country with strong borders. It faces no surge of refugees from war or poverty. Its neighbors are either prosperous or North Korea, which locks its people in. Foreigners are only about 3% of Japan's population. The average across the OECD, a club of mostly rich countries, is 15%. And there's plenty of room for tourism to grow. Japan already relies on foreigners in industries including hospitality, farming, and nursing. Migrants help sustain many of the traditions that nativists fear losing. They catch and harvest raw ingredients for Japanese cuisine. And in some aging rural communities, they help carry portable shrines during festivals. Japan will need far more workers in the coming decades to maintain even modest growth. That is why business leaders and governors tend to favor admitting more foreigners, not fewer. As for curbing tourism, that would mean stifling Japan's second-largest exports, after cars. Instead of discouraging tourism, Japan could lure more of them to the many beautiful places that are currently off the beaten track. Even Kyoto has plenty of spectacular, yet barely visited sites. Instead of cracking down on foreign workers, it could design an immigration system that attracts and selects newcomers with useful skills, integrates them into society, and ensures they pay their fair share of health care and welfare costs. The real problem is not foreigners. It's the failure to take advantage of one of Japan's greatest strengths, that it is a wonderful place to live and work. That was Blaming Outsiders. Does Japan have a foreigner problem? Next, we turn to our third leader article, An Utter Marriage Shell. France is paralyzed and everyone is to blame. The budgetary impasse is just one symptom of collective political uselessness. Over the past 5 years, Europe, once profligate South, has sorted out its public finances. Italy, Greece, and Spain have brought down their budget deficits to levels commensurate with EU rules. The exception is France, which for 3 years has run a huge deficit of over 5% of its GDP. You might think that being economically upstaged by countries that it helped rescue during the Eurozone crisis would focus political minds. Instead, France has failed even to pass a budget for 2026. It now faces the latest in a series of parliamentary battles to adopt one by the end of the month. The budgetary impasse is one symptom of a deeper malady, a severe case of collective political uselessness. Emmanuel Macron is entering the last 15 months of his presidency. He can still act internationally, but is a lame duck at home, viewed favorably by less than 20% of the French. His centrist coalition holds 161 of the 577 seats in the splintered National Assembly, making it virtually impossible to get anything done. The populist right and left delight in Mr. Macron's paralysis. It's a dismal spectacle at a critical time, and everyone shares some of the blame. France's descent into ungovernability began in 2023, when the opposition and the unions whipped up anger over Mr. Macron's sensible pension reform, which raised the minimum retirement age from 62 to 64. With the populist left Unsubmissive France, LFI party, and the populist right National Rally, RN, egging them on, protesters took to the streets to rail against demographic reality. After the RN won the European Parliament elections in 2024, Mr. Macron foolishly called early legislative elections. Those left him with a smaller centrist minority. A new prime minister, Michel Barnier, lasted barely 3 months before the RN and LFI team kicked him to the curb. Mr. Barnier's successor, Francois Bayrou, gamely proposed a budget last July that would have trimmed the deficit to 4.6% of GDP. Parliament balked and toppled him in September. The next prime minister, Sébastien Lecornu, managed to pass part of the budget by caving in to the socialist demand to freeze the pension reform. To get the rest through, he swallowed a long list of new or increased taxes from the socialists, the tiny Greens, and even the RN. But it was not enough. In December, the government rolled over the 2025 budget into 2026. Every major actor in France politics should be ashamed. The extremes seem happy to let France twist in the wind. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the LFI's leader, has his feet planted firmly on the barricades. Marine Le Pen and Jordan Bardella, who lead the RN, hope Mr. Macron goes down in flames so they can swoop to victory at the presidential election in 2027. The socialists and the Greens have no vision for solving France's budget crisis beyond raising taxes. The Republicans, supposedly fiscal conservatives, allowed a suspension of the pension reform that will cost 100 million euros, or 117 million U.S. dollars, in 2026 alone. Perhaps nobody could have imagined this fractious crew. But Mr. Macron's haughty, distant approach has not helped. Finally, one should not spare the blame for the voters, who failed to appreciate Mr. Macron's successful economic policies, refused to accept that welfare systems needed reform, and keep voting for the most irresponsible politicians. This is a bad time for France to be in such a mess. Like the rest of Europe, it's staring down Vladimir Putin while dodging blows from Donald Trump. It needs to find money for a lot more defense spending and to revive an economy menaced by Chinese competition. Yet its debt stock, 117% of GDP, is too high already, so any extra spending must be matched by cuts or higher taxes, and its taxes are already the highest in the G7. France cannot afford to be stuck. If Mr. Lecornu cannot fix the budget by the end of January, he must go, and fresh elections should be called. Though the centrists might improve their position, an RN-led government seems more likely. Being obliged to take responsibility for governing might force the wrecking populace to grow up. It may also fall to the markets rather than the voters to chastise France's useless politicians. That was an utter merde show. France is paralyzed and everyone is to blame. Next, our fourth leader article, Pipeline Dreams. AI is transforming the pharma industry for the better. It's changing the way drugs are discovered and tested. Drug development is notoriously failure-prone. Only one in every 10 drug candidates that enter human trials eventually goes to the market. Turning a promising molecule into a useful medicine typically takes 10 to 15 years after its discovery. These challenging economics mean that the cost of developing each successful drug is roughly $2.8 billion. And because medicines ultimately come off patent, the drive to find the next blockbuster is relentless. Enter generative AI, which the pharma industry is adopting at a terrific rate. By ingesting and analyzing vast biological data sets, AI tools can identify promising target proteins and then suggest novel molecules that could latch onto those drug targets. They can sift through libraries of data to predict the potency and toxicity of candidates before a single test tube is even touched. AI can also help with trials, analyzing health records to find the patients most likely to respond to novel treatments. Though it's still early days, the signs are promising. AI could lead to more efficient drug discovery, better medicines, and more competition in the industry. AI-designed molecules show an 80 to 90% success rate in early-stage safety trials, compared with a historical average of just 40 to 65%. It will be years before it becomes clear whether success rates rise in later-stage trials, too. But even if they do not, one model suggests that early-stage improvements alone could increase the success rate across the entire pipeline from 5 to 10% to 9 to 18%. The industry is also wringing efficiencies out of its business using AI in areas from clinical documentation to HR. Kinsey reckons that if AI is fully utilized by the pharma industry, no doubt with its consultants' assistance, it could provide a boost worth $60 billion to $110 billion annually. The hope is that improvements in the technology will push up the success rate even further. Sophisticated new models for understanding tricky bits of biology are emerging at a rapid pace. A few years ago, an AI model called AlphaFold solved the problem of figuring out the structure of proteins. More complex puzzles, such as how cell membranes function, are likely to be cracked at some point. The technology is already changing how the pharma industry works. A new generation of AI-native biotech startups, particularly in America and China, is emerging. Pharma companies are increasingly forming alliances with AI biotech firms as well as with technology giants including Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and NVIDIA. And those tech firms have their own ambitions in health. Isomorphic Labs, a spin-out from Google DeepMind, is trying to design entirely new therapeutic molecules from scratch inside a computer. NVIDIA, too, has a generative AI platform for drug discovery. Both firms are signing deals to offer design services to pharma companies. And in October, NVIDIA teamed up with Eli Lilly, the world's most valuable drug maker, to build the pharma industry's most powerful supercomputer. All this means that some of the value of drug discovery may be captured by tech giants. For now, pharma firms may have clear advantages, including heaps of data, scientists who know the field, and long experience of shepherding new drugs through a maze of regulations. Over time, though, as parts of biology become more of a computational problem that can be solved with technology, such advantages could be eroded. Pharma firms may need to buy in AI expertise in the same way that they buy early-stage assets from biotech firms today. As drug discovery becomes more efficient, governments will need to turn their attention to other potential bottlenecks in the system, such as regulation and trials. America's Food and Drug Administration and the European Medicines Agency are themselves starting to use AI to screen the mountains of data they receive. As the number of drug candidates rises, faster regulatory review will be needed to avoid a logjam. Governments could also do more to encourage the share of patient data with AI companies in privacy-preserving ways so that AI models and drug discovery can improve. Patents, too, will need rethinking. Today, long patent lives let pharma firms recoup the investments they make, encouraging them to undertake the risky business of drug discovery. Yet if the costs and riskiness of innovation fall dramatically, then patent terms, which typically provide 10 to 15 years of market exclusivity, may need to become shorter. AI brings good news for drug innovation, but to ensure that it benefits both the makers and the takers of new drugs, the industry and its regulators will need to adjust to this new reality. That was Pipeline Dreams. AI is transforming the pharma industry for the better. You're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. If you missed any part of this program or any other of our great broadcasts, you can stream it from our website, sunsounds.org, or from our Sun Sounds mobile app, available for both Apple and Android phones. Now, let's move on to our fifth and final leader article, The Factory Funk. Do not mistake a resilient global economy for populist success. Protectionism is failing to revive manufacturing. Pessimists about the world economy have had a poor run. Global growth was probably about 3% in 2025, far higher than gloomy forecasts made in the spring and summer. That matches the pattern of the decade. Every year so far in the 2020s, the Teflon economy has beaten the World Bank forecast made in June. In 2025, America especially defied expectations. It slowed under Donald Trump, after accounting for the mechanical impact of lower immigration, but only a little. Now, global interest rates have fallen, and in America, China, and Germany, fiscal stimulus is supporting growth. The resilience of the world economy may flummox market liberals because it has coincided with protectionist policies. So far this decade, industrial policy has proliferated, supply chains are fragmented, and Mr. Trump has levied the highest tariffs in America since the 1930s. Yet it's hard at first glance to spot the damage. Populists crow that, as usual, the experts were wrong. They're only half right. It's true that protectionism has not yet derailed growth. But industrial policies and tariffs have also failed in their central aim, arresting the decline of manufacturing jobs. That suggests the world economy is more coping with populism rather than flourishing under it. As we report this week, American manufacturing is in a rut. The sector has contracted every month since March of 2025, according to surveys, which also shows firms complaining about the high cost of imported parts. Over the past year, manufacturers' construction spending has shrunk, as have their payrolls. It's not just in America that the industry is suffering. Globally, manufacturing has lagged behind growth for the past 3 years, calculates J.P. Morgan Chase, a bank. From 2019 to 2025, manufacturing jobs fell as a share of the workforce on every continent except Africa, reckons the International Labor Organization. Bidenomics, Trumponomics, Make in India, and the like have barely dented the long-run trend. Do not bet on that changing. For all the uncertainty hanging over white-collar jobs because of AI, it is factory hands who continue to be the world's most disrupted workers. Pace of decline of the manufacturing jobs as a share of the global workforce has been slightly faster in the 2020s than in the preceding three decades. Recently, job openings have dried up quicker at America's factories than in its offices. And although manufacturing work is not threatened directly by chatbots, AI models trained with data from sensors and cameras are making factory robots better. On January 5th, NVIDIA's boss, Jensen Huang, declared that the ChatGPT moment for robotics is here. That might help output, but it will probably make the jobs that politicians strive to create still scarcer. There is one place where manufacturing is thriving and factory jobs are fairly steady. China, whose share of global manufacturing value added at nearly one-third is almost twice America's. China's industrial might threatens the national security of the West by giving it chokeholds over important industries, but it is hardly proving to be an economic boon. Its leaders' willingness to back manufacturers with state money has distorted the economy. The resulting overcapacity in Chinese factories has contributed to its deflation problem. Ironically, it's the adaptive powers of markets that accounts for the world's economy's resilience to trade barriers. For years, supply chains have snaked around whatever obstacles have been thrown up. And it is America's private sector, not industrial planners in Washington, which is chiefly responsible for the AI boom. The ongoing success of free markets is obscuring the damage protectionism is doing. Do not mistake global economic resilience for a triumph by the likes of Mr. Trump. That was the factory funk. Do not mistake a resilient global economy for populist success. We turn to regional international stories and begin in the Americas with this story. Look nervously south. Canada's armed forces are planning for threats from America. They started rebuilding in 2025 before Donald Trump's most recent bid for hemispheric dominance. Canada has never had an equivalent of Uncle Sam, sternly exhorting its citizens to sign up to fight for their country. That is changing. Jenny Carnegie, Canada's top soldier, is looking for Canadians, whether they are 16 or 65, who will come to their country's aid in the event of a military attack or calamitous natural disaster. We're going to need heavy equipment operators, says General Carnegie. We're going to need drone operators. We're going to potentially need cyber operators as well. Call her Aunt Jenny. There's no direct line between her plan for a 400,000-strong civilian defense force and Donald Trump plucking Venezuela's dictator Nicolas Maduro from his safe house in Caracas, Venezuela, on January 3rd. But nor is the timing entirely coincidental. In the past year, Mr. Trump has repeatedly asserted it would be in Canada's interest to become America's 51st state. No one in a position of responsibility really believes the United States would ever invade. Even Mr. Trump himself, when asked whether he would use military force to annex Canada, has said no, or that it is very unlikely. But all agree that the relationship with the United States has changed irrevocably. Mr. Trump's rhetorical and economic assaults saw to that. Canada had no choice but to try to become a country that can handle threats autonomously, with or without its tempestuous neighbor. Mostly, it worries about incursions by Russia and China, cyber attacks, and assaults on infrastructure. But America's raid on Caracas and subsequent talk of acquiring Greenland, if necessarily by force, means militant action is no longer unthinkable between two countries that have been peaceful since 1815, before Canadian independence. The Department of National Defense, the DND, began discussing the creation of a civil defense capability around the time Mr. Trump suggested he would use economic force to persuade Canadians to join the United States. In this context, it's responsible for the government to assess the full range of scenarios and options, including a voluntary civilian defense force that could support the Canadian Armed Forces, says Marco Mazzucchino, former chief of staff to Mark Carney, Canada's prime minister, and previously the minister in charge of public safety. The DND has gamed out some of those scenarios. Plans are now regularly updated to deal with a surge of migrants who might want to enter Canada from the United States. Mr. Trump's predilection for sending troops into states run by Democrats while using his Justice Department to prosecute his political opponents has compelled Canada to prepare for the event of civil strife next door. Combat planners have also sketched scenarios in which an adversary such as Russia or China might attack Canada's infrastructure or shut down sources of energy or water in order to pin down North American military responders, while one of such foes attacks the Baltic states or Taiwan. Canada is constantly fending off cyber attacks, said General Carnegie. We always are prepared for the worst-case scenarios, she said reassuringly. But officials are not eager to discuss all of them. Quite reasonably, they do not want to provide their potential adversaries any hints about Canada's preparations or vulnerabilities. But they are also preoccupied with trying not to provoke Mr. Trump. Few are willing to be interviewed on the record, but it is a fact that those worst-case scenarios, however unlikely, now include incursions by America. General Carnegie said the plan to muster a civil defense force should please the United States. It meets Mr. Trump's demand that American allies should look after more of their own defense and rely less on the United States in the event of an attack or natural disaster. In November, she dispatched a team to Finland to study that country's extensive civil defense development during decades of being menaced by Russia next door. Under their comprehensive security concept, Finns are expected to store enough food, water, and medical supplies for 72 hours. Lists are kept of civilians trained in medical first aid, rescue, and firefighting, who would lead others to designated bomb shelters dotted across the country. Big enough to hold 85% of Finns, these are not drab post-apocalyptic bunkers. They include underground playgrounds and, of course, saunas. The Canadians were impressed. They have bunkers everywhere, and they make them normal places to be. Some of them have swimming pools in them, said one official. But it was also noted that Canada is 30 times larger than Finland, with vast tracts of sparsely populated territory where it would be nearly impossible to defend its sovereignty without America's help. Mr. Carney wants to change that. He's promising to spend $82 billion Canadian dollars, approximately $59 billion U.S. dollars, over the next 5 years so that Canada is on a path to devoting 5% of its GDP to defense by 2035. Much of that money will be spent in Canada's north. Russian submarines and Chinese research ships making increasing forays into Canada's waters. There's a great threat coming from the north, and we just can't be a liability, said General Carnegie. The Canadian Armed Forces have 67,000 full-time personnel and 27,000 reserves. All of them joined voluntarily. In addition to defending the second-largest country on Earth, they're stretched to the limit with far-flung operations. In Latvia, they bolster the defense of the Baltic states, while in Asia, a naval mission works to keep the Taiwan Strait open to international shipping. The armed forces are also spread thin over Canada's almost 10 million square kilometers. Climate change may have dropped down the list of the country's priorities, but the damage caused by increasingly dangerous weather has not gone away. Troops are regularly called on to help people affected by floods and forest fires. When COVID-19 swept through miserably understaffed old people's homes in the provinces of Ontario and Quebec in 2020, the Army was dispatched to care for them. The new Civilian Defense Force could help with these kinds of emergencies, freeing up the Army to concentrate on defending the homeland from military threats. It may also rouse Canadians from the reverie they've enjoyed since defense spending first drifted below 2% of GDP more than three decades ago. That this meant Canada depended on the United States for much of its territorial defense did not seem to bother anyone. Philippe Lagasse, who studies defense at Carleton University in Ottawa, notes that Canada has never faced threats like those it does today. He says it's hard for the Canadian mind to wrap itself around the new reality. Canada seems to be waking up. That's almost certainly due to Mr. Trump's hemispheric ambitions, now demonstrated with force. General Carnegie says she's regularly besieged after public appearances by Canadians ready to serve. Before Christmas, a senior citizen implored her to deploy him, despite his age. He said, "Listen, I can't carry a rifle and go to war, but I'm out there scanning the internet. I can help. Let me know how I can help you." Look nervously south. Canada's armed forces are planning for threats from America. Next, we turn to China with this story. Military matters. China and Taiwan both see lessons in America's raid on Venezuela. It won't change China's calculus, but it is a case study for decapitation strikes. China's public is used to seeing flashy footage of its armed forces parading new weaponry through Beijing, conducting peacekeeping patrols in Africa, or staging elaborate drills around disputed territory, especially Taiwan. But nobody under 45 can claim to have lived through an actual Chinese military strike on another country. And among older generations who did, most would rather forget the war of 1979 in which Vietnam repelled a Chinese invasion. No wonder, then, that many Chinese people were transfixed by reports of America's dramatic nighttime extraction of Nicolas Maduro from Venezuela. China's government swiftly denounced the raid, but details and discussion of it circulated widely online. Among the most nationalist comments, there were also a common refrain. Could this be a template for Chinese attack on Taiwan? Similar thoughts have been raised in Taiwan itself and in America, with prominent figures arguing that the raid could set a precedent for China's leader, Xi Jinping, to conduct and legitimize an assault on the island. In truth, Mr. Maduro's capture will probably have little direct impact on China's approach to Taiwan. Rhetorically, Chinese officials have already started to use the operation to bolster their long-standing portrayal of America as a global bully and serial violator of international law. But the Trump administration's legal justifications are of little interest to China. More pertinently, China has refrained from attacking thus far, not because it fears foreign reprimand, but owing to its own military limitations and concerns that America would intervene. So, there are lessons to be drawn for both China and Taiwan. Chinese special forces have been planning decapitation strikes on Taiwan's leadership for years. In 2015, China's state television revealed that the People's Liberation Army, or PLA, had built a mock-up of Taiwan's presidential palace in the desert in northern China to practice an assault. The training site has tripled in size since 2020. Models of other Taiwanese ministries have been built, according to satellite images obtained by a Chinese think tank in October. China's focus on decapitation seemingly intensified after the success of Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky in rallying resistance to China's invasion. Decapitation drills have been included in China's recent military exercises around Taiwan, too. The latest, in December 29th and 30th, involved dozens of warships and military aircraft, as well as long-range rocket fire. They simulated a blockade and operations to prevent foreign forces intervening. They also rehearsed strikes on pro-independence figures, according to Senior Colonel Zhang Ji of China's National Defense University. China would need to do more than kill or capture Taiwan's president, Li Ching-te, as that would leave intact the rest of the government, which has a clear line of succession. The PLA is thus likely to use decapitation strikes as part of a bigger operation, potentially a full-scale invasion. Still, the PLA's own elite units have yet to conduct any operations of note at home, let alone abroad. Nor has China yet established the high-level integration of space, air, ground, and other forces that's needed for such operations, despite reforms that Mr. Xi introduced more than a decade ago to achieve that. So China is likely to scrutinize America's raid on Caracas, just as it had studied other significant foreign operations with potential relevance to Taiwan, including the D-Day landings and the Falklands War. Taiwan will likely be hungry for insight into the American raid. Its armed forces are better equipped and trained than Venezuela's, but they've long worried about Chinese decapitation strikes potentially involving sleeper agents already in Taiwan. Xu Shenxian, the island's deputy defense minister, told reporters on January 5th that Taiwan's armed forces had protocols to respond to various types of Chinese aggression. Those include the so-called Wan Chun plan to protect the president, details of which are secret. The Venezuela raid showed the importance of strengthening preparedness and ensuring weapons are upgraded and maintained, he said, linking the episode to his government's recent effort to boost defense spending blocked by the opposition. One detail of particular interest to Taiwan is the apparent failure of Venezuela's Chinese-made JY-27 air surveillance radars. Their manufacturer describes them as jam-resistant, and Chinese state media have claimed they can detect incoming missiles and advanced stealthy aircraft, including America's F-22 jet fighters. Though the radar's failure in Venezuela may have been due to poor maintenance, operator error, or even sabotage, any suggestion that America exploited a weakness could affect China's perception of its own vulnerability in a Taiwan conflict. Versions of the same radars also protect the mainland. But perhaps more significant for both sides is what the Venezuela operation says about the Trump administration's willingness to use force and its new focus on the Western Hemisphere. Taiwanese officials suggested that it could deter China by demonstrating America's willingness to deploy military might against autocracies. On the other hand, mainland officials may be quietly encouraged by Mr. Trump's suggestion that his next targets could be Mexico, Colombia, or even Greenland. That does not necessarily mean giving Mr. Xi carte blanche on Taiwan, but if America is bogged down in its own backyard, China could reap the benefits all the same. That was Military Matters. China and Taiwan both see lessons in America's raid on Venezuela. Next, we'll turn back to the United States with this article, Threading the Needle, Why Overdose Deaths Are Falling in America. Researchers point to a grocer's favorite. A jar of peanut butter is not what it used to be. Look at the bottom, and for some jars, the dimple has grown deeper over time. The amount of peanut butter has reduced while appearing the same size. Shrinkflation, as the downsizing is known, is common enough as manufacturers try to keep prices the same when production costs rise. New research posits that this same strategy might be behind America's dramatic recent fall in the overdose death rate. Deaths from opioid overdoses have decreased from almost 85,000 in the year to June 2023 to 48,000 in the year to April of 2025, the most recent data available. Researchers have pondered what could have caused this sudden turnaround, pointing to the end of the COVID-19 pandemic or a rise in drug treatment. A new article published in Science on January 8th suggests instead that a supply shock drove the decrease. Written by a collaboration of top-tier opioid researchers from the University of Maryland, Stanford, and beyond, the paper uses data from drug seizures to show that fentanyl powder and pills were losing potency just as overdose deaths were falling. This indicates that drug dealers were finding it harder to source fentanyl and were turning to shrinkflation. Lots of things can reduce overdoses, but there's only one thing that can reduce overdoses massively, suddenly, and across whole nations, said Keith Humphreys, one of the paper's authors, and that's supply control. About 70% of American overdose deaths are caused by fentanyl, a synthetic opioid. Networks shift, but currently most American street fentanyl starts as building block chemicals produced in China. Those are shipped to Mexico, where drug gangs formulate them into fentanyl and smuggle it across the border. Analyzing data from the Drug Enforcement Administration, the research shows that the purity of fentanyl powder peaked in July of 2023, before falling more than half to the end of 2024. This follows a similar pattern as the overdose death rate. Even as quality worsens, prices in drug markets are sticky, so the decreasing potency probably meant people were taking less fentanyl. This did not go unnoticed by users. In a novel turn, the Science article also analyzes posts on Reddit, a message board platform. There, mentions of fentanyl drought spiked throughout late 2023 until January 2024 when moderators cracked down on such chatter. Canada had a similar opioid epidemic, but a different supply chain, largely skipping over Mexico. Because Canada saw similar falls in fentanyl strength, the researchers hypothesized that the supply shock was caused by something changing in China. Other researchers are skeptical. There was simply no collaboration with China and no Chinese actions taken before November of 2023, said Vanda Felbab Brown of the Brookings Institute, a think tank, pointing out that the death rate started to fall well before. Although she finds the case for a supply shock persuasive, her research shows that prior to late 2024, there was no precursor shortage in Mexico. Similarly, Daniel Ciccarone, an opioid researcher at the University of California, San Francisco, researches the supply shock is not the complete answer. Looking at the breakdown of overdose deaths by state, he sees an epidemic naturally ending. There aren't that many people who want to do serious opioids, Mr. Ciccarone said. He sees the 2023 death rate as unsustainable. Epidemics burn out, he said, whether it's COVID or Ebola or drug overdoses. He argues that a supply shock happened at the same time and probably accelerated the fall a little bit. However large the role of the supply shock was, it will have implications for the next stage of the epidemic. China and America have been increasing cooperation on drug policy as part of a cooling down of the trade war. But China's government could ease up on enforcement of chemical export restraints should relations worsen. Or perhaps chemical manufacturers in another country, such as India, will expand to meet remaining demand. Yet even if the supply shocks prove temporary, this would still be the most spectacular achievement we've had in terms of saving lives in the opioid epidemic, said Mr. Humphreys. So I will celebrate that. And rightly so. That was Threading the Needle, Why Overdose Deaths Are Falling in America. Finally, we turn to Europe for this article, Terrifyingly Leaky Chernobyl. a Russian drone has revived a Ukrainian nuclear nightmare. But who's prepared to pour even more money into making the country safe? One night in late February, flames leapt over the Chernobyl nuclear power plant for the first time since 1986, when it was the site of the history's worst nuclear disaster. A Russian drone had punched a hole in the reactor's protective dome, known as the New Safe Containment, or NSC. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, a UN watchdog, initially called the damage superficial. But repairs are likely to cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Experts say there's a risk of a severe leak. The NSC was completed in 2019. The project, orchestrated by the European Bank for Reconstruction and Redevelopment, the EBRD, took 22 years and cost $1.6 billion. Placed atop the concrete sarcophagus erected after the meltdown, it was designed to contain radiation for the next century. The drone blasted a hole in it and started a fire. To fight it, some 300 openings had to be cut into the structure, said Balthasar Lindauer, the EBRD's head of nuclear safety. Fire destroyed parts of its airtight seal, making it vulnerable to corrosion in a few years. Mr. Lindauer said such corrosion could lead parts of the post-1986 sarcophagus to collapse and stir up radioactive dust. That would be released around the reactor. Beyond that, he hesitates to speculate. There's been no radioactive leak since the drone attack, but without repairs, says Rafael Mariano Grossi, the IAEA's director, it will become a far more costly threat. In October, Ukrainian employees covered the gaping hole made by the drone with a metal sheet. A contractor will try to patch the holes made by firefighters. But to restore the NSC's integrity, the dome must be resealed. The question is how to do this without exposing many workers to high levels of radiation. One option is removing the NSC, fixing it off-site, and replacing it. It's the largest movable land-based structure in the world. The EBRD is trying to raise the funds, but asking for money to send to Ukraine is at present a hard sell. That was Terrifyingly Leaky Chernobyl. A Russian drone has revived a Ukrainian nuclear nightmare. For the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the January 9th edition of The Economist. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell, here on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and it's been my pleasure to read them. Thank you for listening. Tune in next week or for another edition of The Economist, and stay tuned for more interesting programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.